Because in San Diego, I might run into people I know. So I go to Hollywood to really, you know, to really be myself, which was a drunk. Or Hawaii, or the river, or Las Vegas. And basically, I was an 80s party girl. That's what I was. And I loved it. I was really good at it. And it was like, I said, oh, you know, I have a PhD in fun. And I would have really big parties at my house, really, really big parties. One of my birthday parties, I called it Jack Daniels birthday party. And I walked around with the Jack Daniels. I was giving shots to everyone and took one myself for everyone. And yeah. Yeah, and I like Jack Daniels. Because you didn't have the illusion. You know, it burned going down. And I loved that burn. I loved it. Because it really felt like you were drinking. You know? Oh, sweet little 18-year-old girl, I love that burn. But that's who I was. And And, you know, for a while it worked. And then it wasn't working so good. But by that time, I didn't know what else to do. I mean, I had the occasion where, you know, I never was arrested for drunk driving. But I got in an accident where I almost killed myself and my friend. You know, and, you know, he's good drinker, and he just had the presence of mind and said, let's get the hell out of here. You know, and I just left the scene, but, you know, it wasn't good, and we were drinking in the car, so it's there, but for the grace of God, go I. And I think about that all the time. That happened on Lake Murray Boulevard, and I went between one of the trees, two of the trees, and then I went back over the center divider, and I just missed, there's like a light post there. And it's between Cowles Mountain and Lake Murray Boulevard there. And whenever I see that, I think, you know, yeah, there but for the grace of God go I. It's like I could have been dead there. And instead, here I am standing here telling you my alcoholic story. And, yeah. So towards the end of the drinking, I just didn't know what else to do. I had dollar drink night. That was good. And I was a bar drinker. I was a bar drinker and party drinker. And I wasn't going to the bar to drink, by the way. I was going to the bar because I was looking for a man. And yet, I never really wanted to interrupt any of my happy hours or drink nights for dates. That was seemed to be a waste of time. I didn't really notice that till later. It was like I kind of got irritated when a guy actually wanted to go on a date because what I really wanted to do was go to the bar. And, yeah. And so what happened was my dad was an actively drinking alcoholic, and I was very troubled by his alcoholism. As a teenager, one of the reasons I was out so much is because he was drinking all the time. We moved, as I said, I grew up in Berwyn, Illinois. It was very middle-class area. I was very sheltered. I had my grandparents nearby. And actually, I look back on it now, and I pretty much had, up until I was 13 years old, I mean, it was a pretty ideal childhood. And I was very, very blessed. I mean, we weren't rich, but we weren't poor. My grandfather arranged for his alcoholic son to get some government job in Chicago, which you can't get fired from. And, you know, that it worked. And then my dad's drinking progressed, and he wanted to move to San Diego. He said it was for the son. I know today it was to get away from his father and to get away from that observation of what he was doing. And he moved to San Diego, and we were isolated here. And my dad drank all the time. He never got a job. My mom started working two jobs, and I started drinking. You know, and my brothers got real isolated with themselves, and I had been so close to my grandparents, you know, and there they were, you know, back in the Midwest, and I missed them so much, and I filled the hole with partying. I redefined myself as a partier. And I knew my dad's drinking was a problem, and I thought, well, maybe the reason that I'm having all this problem with guys is because my dad's an alcoholic. And then I had this friend who was going to Al-Anon. And she was dating a guy who was an alcoholic, and his mother was an Al-Anon, and she was just insisting she go to Al-Anon, and she did, and she started to change. She had been really perfectionistic and really pretty controlling, and she started to change. She started to be quite a pleasant person. And that was attractive, and she kept calling me every Wednesday and saying, oh, Catherine, do you want to go to that Al-Anon meeting with me? Oh, yes, I want to go to that Al-Anon meeting. Yes, yes, yes. The problem was, there was this old bar back in the early 90s called Moose. It had dollar drink night on Wednesday night. Yeah, they had dollar drink night on Wednesday night, and the Al-Anon meeting that she wanted me to go to was on Wednesday night, and it was a conflict. So I found it very difficult to give up, you know, dollar drink night for even one Wednesday to go to an Al-Anon meeting. She practiced the 12 step in the best possible way that any of us could know. She just called me with the most pleasant tone of voice every Wednesday after work. Oh, Catherine, do you want to go to the Al-Anon meeting? Oh, yeah, Kim, I really, really want to go, but not this week. And she just did it until, you know, what happened is that God took one party friend after the other away. You know, one girl moved to Chico, and one girl moved to the Bay Area, and another friend and I got into a drunken brawl on Halloween. And so the people that I used to go party with, all of them were kind of going away somehow, and I didn't have anyone to go to dollar drink night with one time. And so I went to the Al-Anon meeting just because I didn't have anyone to go to the party with. For no other reason than I had nothing to do on Wednesday, I went to that Al-Anon meeting. And I went in there, and I felt like I felt scared is how I felt. It's because they knew. They knew what it was like to grow. It was recovering adult children, and they knew what it was like to grow up in an alcoholic home. They knew how it was to just watch your father slowly, you know, just disappear in the drink. And to watch your mother, you know, unravel being the queen of denial and saying, well, you know, your father loves you so much. It's just, you know, sometimes he has a drinking problem. Yeah, she's the queen of denial, so that makes me the princess. And, I am the princess. Because then there I was going to so I started going to Al-Anon every Wednesday. Eventually, I was able to commit to every Wednesday night. And I started going to Al-Anon every Wednesday. And somebody suggested I get a sponsor, so I got a sponsor, and she happened to be married to an alcoholic who went to AA. You know, he went to Water Walkers up here and stuff, and they started working the steps out of the AA Big Book in 12 and 12. Well, that's not normal in Al-Anon, I have to let you know. That's one of my first miracles in recovery. See, it's not normal in Al-Anon to work the steps out of the AA Big Book in 12 and 12, but that's what she did. And see, it's very difficult for an alcoholic to read the AA Big Book or 12 and 12 and not recognize themselves. And I said to myself, gosh, I really identify strongly with the alcoholic as an adult child. Because I didn't want it to be me. You see, the worst thing in the world, the person who ruined my life, I hated him with a passion, was my father. I hated him for what he did to our family. I hated him for what he did to me. I hated him for destroying himself. And I never wanted to be an alcoholic. I never wanted to have anything to do with an alcoholic. And that was the worst case scenario. And when I started seeing myself, I was an unhappy person. So, of course, I continued to drink. but the problem is that I had read, it was that first step in the 12 and 12. That's the part that got me. It was just like how, you know, they talk about, and you'll understand this, Nate, it's like, well, where can they raise the bottom up so that it hit us? With the people who still had the job and they still, you know, they hadn't lost everything. It's like we can go back in our drinking careers and see where even then it was no mere habit. And at that time, I was not nearly as honest about how much I was drinking and how often as I was drinking as I am today, because I couldn't see it. I really believed I didn't really drink. And it wasn't until I was sober and my sponsor walked me through it and started asking me some questions that I started seeing how much it was. And and how serious it was. And, I mean, I didn't even mention, I mean, I used to be a regular blackout drinker. Regularly. And apparently normal drinkers don't do that all the time. Apparently that doesn't happen to them. But see, I didn't recall it. I just didn't recall it. It just like was gone. And so I was reading this book in the 12 and 12, and what happened was, see, Nate reminded me so much of what they call in AA your Eskimo. Because what happened is I lived over by San Diego State. I had gone to San Diego State. I graduated from San Diego State. And I had a house where I had two roommates because I needed to defray costs so I had money to party. And you know, I thought I was doing so good because I had a job. I graduated, I had a job. But I was basically living at 28 exactly the same way I was at 18. It was nothing had changed. Nothing had progressed in my life. And so I had roommates. So this guy comes over. I put an ad in the Reader. And so this guy comes over, and he said that, and I, at this time I'm in Al-Anon, right? And he's like, oh, yeah, well, the thing is, I'm an alcoholic, and I've been sober for 5 years. And for those of you who are new, maybe you think somebody with 5 years of sobriety, I thought that was amazing. I couldn't even believe anybody could be 5 years sober. And he was like, you know, he was like, yeah, 25 years old, and he had like 5 years of sobriety, and I just thought that was amazing. I thought he must be some kind of spiritual guru or something. How could he be 5 years without drinking, you know? And so I wanted him to be my roommate because I was so amazed that anyone could be sober for 5 years. And so he did. But I had I counted it at one time, I had 13 roommates over the years. You know, so I had a lot of experience with different people coming and going. So he just was going to school, doing his thing. He had his roommate, and I was, you know, going to work and going out to the bar is what I was doing. But that's what I did. But see, every once in a while, he and I would talk, and you know, I think he knew right away what I was, but he didn't say anything. He was also an excellent, excellent one for 12-stepping me, because he never said, Catherine, you're an alcoholic. I can see it as clear as day. He never said that to me. And when I would say, do you think I, you know, didn't really drink? And he was like, that's just alcoholic, that's just a label. He never called me an alcoholic. I can't believe that. That was, I mean, do you understand the kind of, you know, self-restraint to be in Alcoholics Anonymous living with an active drinker, and he never actually put the label on me. He was like, that's a label. But then when I was in Al-Anon, I got real active in the Al-Anon, and so then he was going to an AA dance. And he said, well, maybe you want to go to this dance. They're going to have a speaker, and then they're going to have a dance, and, you know, maybe you want to go. And I had already been wondering whether I was an alcoholic or not. I was going back and forth. Am I not? Right? And, you know, my Al-Anon sponsor had ordered me to go to this open AA step study meeting, right? So I was going to the Al-Anon meeting once a week, and then I was going to this open AA step study. And I was really surprised at how much I was identifying with the alcoholics, not the Al-Anons. And so then he asked me to this AA dance. And so I went to the AA dance with him. And I think the speaker was actually Dr. Paul, who read Dr. Addict Alcoholic. Yeah. And, you know, that was a real good speaker. And then at the dance, I'm like standing there. And this is like one of my next miracles in recovery, is that I'm at the dance and this guy I went to high school with comes up to me and said, oh, Kathy, it's so good to see you finally got sober. And you know what I said to him? I said, it's good to be sober. And that was my sobriety date, June 5th, 1993. See, because Rick didn't know I wasn't an alcoholic in my mind. So he didn't know to, you know, not label me. He had drank with me in high school. He assumed I was there to get sober. And I said, it's good to be sober. And he and I, like, went out to coffee and, you know, and just, like, newcomers were, like, talking to each other and really supported each other. But I haven't taken a drink since then. And that is not through my own power. That is because at that point, once I said that to him, I was like, oh, God, I'm an alcoholic. It was the worst case scenario. And So, and then I was like, oh, and I'm a compulsive overeater, and I got, you know, I got this sex and love addiction thing going on, and you know, and I'm an adult child, and I'm an alcoholic, and what meeting do I go to? And then somebody's like, whoa. Whoa, Catherine, you know, only one of those things is going to kill you, and that's your alcoholism. Why don't you focus on your alcoholism, work the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous around your alcoholism, and then just take it one day at a time. Okay, yeah, and I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps right in that first year, and because of my issues with 13th steppers, I only went to women's meetings in my first year. I did have this 13th step experience before I got sober. See, I was in Al-Anon and I wasn't an alcoholic, and some friend of my sponsor, my Al-Anon sponsor's husband, you know, 13th, and I thought he was so smart because he was sober. And you know, it just really messed me up. It completely messed me up. So because of that, most women come here and they're not all messed up from a 13th step experience before they even admit they're an alcoholic. But see, I went to this AA convention in Laughlin as an Al-Anon, right? I'm an Al-Anon. And he's like messing with me because, you know, that's how we are. And that's, we mess with each other. And that's what we do. But that's part of the experience. And all I wanted to do was drink. That's all I wanted to do. I'm at an AA convention, and all I wanted to do was drink. So, you know, I did what any normal alcoholic would did. I took a Valium. And it was only later I found out that was alcoholism. You know, that desire to escape our feelings. And So then I only went to women's meetings. So I got sober. I went to women's meetings. I didn't date. I worked the steps. And I went to a meeting every day. You know, I didn't think I had to go to a meeting every day because I didn't drink every day. I only drank like 5 days a week. So I didn't, you know, I didn't think I needed, well, sometimes 6 days. I mean, sometimes seven. But, you know. But I ended up going to a meeting every day, and I didn't understand at that time. You go to a meeting every day because you need to get into the habit of connecting with alcoholics, to talk to alcoholics. You need to get into the habit of making friends with sober alcoholics. And that's what I did. I made friends with sober alcoholics. Because if those are the people you're associating with, the winners, the people who are sober, if those are the people you're calling, if those are the people you're telling your story to, then what you're getting feedback isn't, you know, the advice when you're in fear and uncomfortableness. The advice isn't, you know, fuck everything and run, fear, right? The advice is face everything and recover. You can do it. You can walk through it. And, of course, the quality of my problems when I got sober was, I mean, when I was young, it wasn't that complicated. As I said, my life had been on hold from 18 to 28. It was exactly the same. I had the same exact lifestyle. It never progressed. So it wasn't that complicated. But after I got sober, and then I worked the steps, and I had been going to a meeting every day, and then I started thinking, you know, around 2 years, I started thinking I was better or something. I don't know. Yeah. So I started cutting back on my meetings a little bit, just a little bit. I didn't need to go to a meeting every day anymore, right? And I got a different job. I was working up at USD, and there was a lot of really wealthy people up there. And I didn't think I had a problem with it, but then it started disturbing me, and I had some inventory. And then I realized that I had a resentment towards people with money because my dad had a resentment towards people with money. It wasn't even my resentment. It's amazing. You know, it's amazing what you find out in inventory, right? It's amazing. And so then somebody told me, well, if you have a resentment about that, why don't you just start going to meetings in La Jolla? What? I mean, I was going to meetings in La Mesa. That was my comfort zone, right? I was living over by San Diego State. I was going to, and it was just like, oh, and yeah. And, you know, it was really good because it had the exact prescribed effect. The exact prescribed effect was to, you know, make me see that I'm part of, that I'm part of the human race. I'm just a person. And people are just people regardless of, you know, geographic location. You know, they introduced me to Catherine from Lakeside. You know, back when I was drinking, I dated a guy from Lakeside. God, I looked down on that guy. You know, I did. I just thought I was so much better than him. And, you know, it's just, and as God would have it, that's where I am. You know, and it's fine with me. And there's awesome recovery there. And there's awesome recovery in El Cajon. And, you know, and I'm very happy. Yeah, exactly. And I'm really happy with it. And then we get to, you know, the second step, what a power greater than self can do for me. And for me, the second step has always been both powerful but also a stumbling block. You see, right before I got sober and I was in Al-Anon, my father, my drinking alcoholic father, he died. He died, you know, a drinking alcoholic. He died of heart failure because his heart was enlarged. And that's what happens to us. And he was had just turned 54. And the last time I saw him, you know, I was in Al-Anon, and I know he had been court-ordered to go to AA several times for DUIs, and I just, you know, I was, like, new in the steps, and I couldn't understand why he, you know, I couldn't get it. And I looked in his eyes, and I mean, I saw it. He believed that God could do it for me, but he didn't believe that God would do it for him. And, you know, every time I go to an AA meeting, you know, and I think about, you know, we pray for the alcoholic who still suffers. You know, it's like there's an alcoholic suffering. There's still an alcoholic suffering out there. There's still an alcoholic suffering right in this room. A lot of them. They're not talking. But a lot of us are suffering right in the room, you know. And there's alcoholics who, you know, they didn't hit their bottom till it wasn't in this life. And I would not, I know for a fact that when Rick said to me, Kathy, good to see you finally got sober, I would not have stayed sober if I was not convinced that alcoholism leads to death. I had to be convinced of that, but I knew it was true. And if you come to enough meetings and you listen long enough, I mean, we can find, you know, 1,000 ways to die. And some of it is the guy who just relapsed and drank himself, you know, this is the guy I knew in Germany, just drank himself to death, and or fallen off the roof, or the drunk driving, or the, you know, it's just, and the reason I talk about the fatal nature is because I would like to say that I'm just a good person who saw I was an alcoholic and didn't want to live that last 10 or 15 miserable years, and I didn't, but I don't think I would stay sober if I didn't think it would result in death. And I mention it because that's what it is for me and for all of us. And if you notice, when an alcoholic from any meeting, it doesn't mean it's the 3-minute speaker or the 5-minute speaker, when they talk about that aspect, it gets real quiet in the room because every single one of us knows someone. And there but for the grace of God go I. And every single day that I am standing here, I'm an exception to the rule because, see, I shouldn't be sober. I should not be sober. I am the daughter of an alcoholic. I am the granddaughter of an alcoholic. I'm the great-granddaughter of an alcoholic. I got it well and good. And my mother's father, my control freak Al-Anon mother, her father, I just found this out. I just found it out. I've been sober for 17 years. I just found it out. And I told her, oh, I have my AA birthday. Do you remember at the Lakeside Hotel I had my AA birthday? And I was just telling my mother, and nobody in my family's in recovery, and they don't care how long I've been sober, and it doesn't mean anything to them, right? And I was showing my mom my token, not that she cares, but, you know, I just was showing her anyway because I guess I was a little bit happy. And she was like, oh, yeah, you know, I think my dad did that AA thing for a while. I'm like, what? My mom was born in Cleveland in 1940. And apparently the only reason my grandmother came back to her, to my grandfather in 1939 is my grandfather got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1939. I mean, that's like Dr. Bob and the good old timers, you know? And so I'm literally, you know, the granddaughter of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, and then my mom's just like, oh, yeah. But my grandfather, he relapsed after 7 years. My grandmother, my mother was born, my aunt was born, both my aunt and my mother have a lot of wonderful children outside of me. And, you know, well, I'm a little bit the black sheep. But none of those people would exist. And they have wonderful families, too, if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous. Because he got sober, and he was sober for 7 years. And he had those two girls that he wouldn't have had otherwise. And so, you know, it did produce something, even though he relapsed and he died on the street in Cleveland. So, you know, I got it good. And so today, then here we go in my story some more. I have some more story. So I was in meetings in La Jolla, right? We'll get back to La Jolla. I was in the meetings, going to the meetings in La Jolla. But the thing is, they have a lot of big meetings in La Jolla. They're kind of big. And there was a lot of good recovery, but I was mostly sitting in the back, and I wasn't talking too much, and I wasn't going to too many coffees after the meeting, and I kind of got really, really anonymous in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is a scary and dangerous place for us to be. I mean, I was attending meetings, but nobody knew my story. I was attending meetings, but nobody knew if I was having a good day or a bad day. And that's a really scary place for us. And you know, we have San Diego, I mean, if the recovery here is so great, we have an embarrassment of riches. We got all these people with loads of time and all this experience, strength, and hope. And there you are when you're 2.5, 3 years sober. You know, you don't feel like you got that much to transmit. And I was just faded away. And what happened is I got real depressed. I was going to work. I was sober. I had some friends in AA. I had, you know, roommates from recovery. But I just kept, you know, isolating more and more and more and getting more just, that's what we do. We isolate. And I was getting that's what happened. And I was hardly going to meetings. I was still going to meetings, but like I said, I was hiding in the back. And what happened was, when I was about 2 years sober, we had that international convention, if any of you long-term people know, that big international convention in, 95, right. So, right, I was 2 years sober, right? That's a great time to go to an international convention. I was 30 years old and 2 years sober. It was a great time. And, you know, there was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And we had a bunch of guys from San Francisco that stayed at my house. I had another sober roommate. What happened was some of the guys from San Francisco were coming down to San Diego, and he called me up and said, "Oh, I'm coming down to San Diego, and can I come there?" And I'm like, "Sure." And he never ended up coming to San Diego, but a friend of mine ended up having a wedding in the Bay Area. And so I called him up and I said, "Well, I happen to be going to a wedding in the Bay Area." And he's like, "Oh, okay, we'll pick you up from the airport." And I wasn't asking for a ride, but okay. And they picked me up from the airport and they took me to a meeting directly. See, I had been kind of fading away in AA, right? Here I am about 3 years sober, and I had been fading away. I wasn't so active. They took me to a meeting right away. And they were super active in recovery, and they were working the steps, and they were working with newcomers all the time. And they took me to like 3 meetings a day that first day. And I had been depressed and fading away in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And not knowing where to go. Oh, and by the way, I just lost my job. Yeah, that's right. Of course. I just lost my job. And I really didn't have anywhere to go. And then everyone went to work, and it was during the day, and I kind of was walking around after a meeting. And, you know, over there at Union, Union Square, is that what it's called down there in downtown San Francisco? I was kind of walking around and just sitting there. And I had gone to a couple meetings, and I didn't know where I was going to go or what I was going to do. And there was, like, some pigeons there, you know, fly away. And I just start walking around San Francisco. I mean, all my friends are at work, and I'm unemployed. I don't know what's going to happen. And I start walking. This guy was walking in front of me with his friend. He turns around. I'm walking behind him, and he just turns around out of the blue. Some guy on the street in San Francisco. "What do you do when you're not drinking?" And I'm like, "I don't drink at all." And then he says to his friend, "See, there's lots of people who don't drink." And then I'm like this puppy. I like following these guys, right? And it was just like they're engaging me in conversation. And, you know, and basically this guy was 12-stepping a friend of his from work is what was happening. And I still to that day do not know what that man's name is. But, you know, I was a lost alcoholic who was lost in AA. I wasn't active in my recovery at all. And that guy took me to another meeting, and he sat down to coffee, and I told him my story because I didn't tell the guy I met at the international convention because I wanted to look good to him, right? I wanted to look good in AA. But the other guy, the stranger, I told him, you know, I told him that I was not, you know, doing any work. And he said, Catherine, it sounds like you've totally forgotten who you are. You are an alcoholic, and you need Alcoholics Anonymous. And from that day, I started going to meetings every day. I got a sponsor up. I stayed up in San Francisco for a while. I got a sponsor up there. I reworked the steps right then and there. And I was doing the inventory every day. And, I became, you know, more a full member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at that time, I had, like, this opportunity to go to Sweden because I had a friend that had, like, this thing. And that she wanted me to do. And when I was drinking, I didn't. My world was really small. It was like PB. It was like going out to. It was a really small little party. It was just this little small world. I mean, I went on vacation, but it was always like river. You know, get drunk there. And so then I had this opportunity to go to Sweden and work in Sweden, and I was terrified. And my sponsor just kept saying, just do your inventory, and if it's God's will for you to go to Sweden, you'll go to Sweden. If it's not, you won't. But you get on that plane, it's God's will. If it's not, you won't. And I got on the plane, and I went to Sweden. And I started going to meetings in Sweden. And in Stockholm at that time, that was back in like 96, 97, they had a lot of chronic relapsers. They didn't really talk about God. Nobody had worked the steps. And I felt... Unlike in La Jolla, I felt very purposeful in Alcoholics Anonymous in Stockholm. And so I started carrying this message of recovery. And for a while, I was the only person in the room talking about God and steps and stuff like that. But, it was like, okay, it was a dissenting voice there, whatever. And then after about a year that I was there, this guy came from the Pacific group. And so then it was like two alcoholics, right, sharing the message. It was Frederick and me. And it was like all of a sudden, people started recovering and staying sober. Yeah, they did. And I mean, I have some friends to this day that, I mean, we had this little teeny, teeny, tiny meeting on Sunday night in Stockholm. And if you only know how dark it is in Stockholm in the winter, even at 4 o'clock, because it's like on the same latitude as like Juneau, Alaska. And it was like Sunday night, and it was this international meeting, so it was the English-speaking meeting. And sometimes it would only be like me and one other person, or sometimes it would just be me and the big book. And, you know, I went to that meeting every time, but sometimes, you know, you got some alcoholic there who was on vacation, and they were, you know, it was life or death. If that meeting hadn't been there, you know, who knows what would have happened. And it was such a powerful experience, to that meeting of service. See, when you're being of service, when you're suiting up, showing up, doing what's in front of you, it doesn't matter if it's like a wonderful experience in a gigantic international convention or a big meeting like here on Saturday night. That doesn't matter. Sometimes that service is just showing up to that one little teeny tiny meeting and being the only person there for the person who, you know, might otherwise not come back. And it is a matter of life and death. See, these meetings, we have a lot of fun. I've had a lot of fun in AA when I was single, the dances and everything. But really, it's serious business. It's life and death. And so when I show up to that little meeting, and the only speaker at the meeting was somebody from the big book, that's what we used to do. And it was the same group of people. You know, in Stockholm, the English-speaking group, we had like, you know, we had maybe a core group of maybe 20 people and a peripheral group of maybe 35 people, you know, that would go to the meetings. And, you know, you get to know people really well, really well. And there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go because there's only this one group of English-speaking people. And when somebody, you get a resentment against somebody, you have to keep coming back. You have to keep coming back to the same group. And what I learned from that experience is that same person that was so annoying and I was so resentful towards her, and I kept coming back and I kept coming back. And over time, she became one of my greatest teachers. And the only reason I kept coming back is because it wasn't El Cajon or San Diego where I had so many meetings that I could get a resentment and just go somewhere else. I had to deal with that relationship. And I had to grow up in that relationship. And when those business meetings could get very, very, you know, emotional, as they do. And I grew up, and that same woman, that annoying woman who, you know, didn't ever sponsor in all these years of sobriety. And then I'm like, why did you just get a sponsor? And then... You know, a year later, she did, and she got better. And I went back to Stockholm this summer, and, you know, I wish I had her story. And she's doing so good. And it was the person, you know, who's the most annoying one. And I just have to say that. We don't know how God works and who God's working through. And God's working through our defects, even today. And then I, so I was in Stockholm for 7 years. And when I went back, my husband is Swedish. I met a Swedish man and I married him. And he's, after a while, he didn't like Lakeside so much and he went back to Stockholm. No. But he's in, it's the economy. He lost his job and he got a job in Sweden. And so I went back there to visit him. And, you know, they had the European Young People in AA convention this summer, the first ever in Stockholm. And they told me there that in Stockholm now they have more sober alcoholics per capita than any other city in Europe. Yeah, more than London, more than Dublin. You would think that London, I mean, London AA can be really good. They have lots more meetings in London, you know. They have lot, but the, and I had to think, and I know I've been to meetings in Germany and some other places, I couldn't help but think. It was like, well, you know, every once in a while you have the privilege to, like, be involved with something. And I just was one alcoholic. There was other people, you know, who worked really hard to lay those foundations and take it out. And I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to mention his name again, but that guy from, he was Swedish and went out to the Swedish AA and he really carried the message there. But one alcoholic carrying the message can make such a difference. And we don't even know the lives that we save. And to me, and oh, I'm not that short on time, but I have to say this. I'm the kind of person, if I told you about my La Jolla meetings time, I'm the kind of person that isolates. That's my worst quality. I isolate so bad. And I get myself into a load of misery, just like wanting to look good and not telling anyone how much it's hurting. And every single time, the alcoholic who has saved my life is not the one who gives me their phone number and says, call anytime. Always the one who has saved my life has been the one who's given me their phone number, but also taken my phone number and then called me. That's the one that saved my life over and over again. The woman in Stockholm who, there was hardly any woman in those English-speaking meetings, who kept calling me because she just wanted another woman there. Oh, my gosh. You know, when I was having, you know, all those, I had infertility when I was in Stockholm. I couldn't get pregnant, and I was so sad. And when she was calling me to go to a meeting all the time, she kept me coming back. You know, she kept me coming back when I wanted to hide. And then when I came out here, I had my miracle. You know, I got pregnant against all odds. I was 39 years old when I got pregnant. It shouldn't have happened. And when my son was born, he was born with a life-threatening birth defect. And he's a wonderful little boy. He keeps me coming back to this meeting, actually. This is his favorite meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's 6 years old. He loves the babysitter. He loves the other kids back there. And when my husband went to Sweden to work and I was having, like, Saturday nights alone, Carol said to me, I got to know this meeting with the babysitter. And it's like a professional babysitter because, you know, I'm like a mom who's all protective, right? And so I come there and he loved the babysitter and he loved the other kids. And now he's the one, Mommy, we're going to the meeting, right? We're going to the meeting. And but he does have that life-threatening birth defect. And he, you know, he got sick the other night, and we ended up in last night I was in the hospital at Children's Hospital with him. And, you know, I walked through it with grace and dignity, and I was like, should I cancel my speaking because I'm all upset about my son getting sick and all this? And I open up the big book and I read a story, because that's what I learned in Stockholm at that tiny little meeting, right? Go to a speaker, go to a story at the back of the book. And I read this story about the man who mastered fear, who, you know, he was so shy and he didn't want to go and speak and stuff, but he wanted AA in Chicago. So he would go and speak, and then after he got done speaking, he felt like $1 million. And that was the story I happened to read. And I was just like, okay, you got your message. You're supposed to do it anyway, even though you feel like a basket case. And I don't know what God's will is for me today. I mean, it's March, so we're certainly on the third step. And when I first got sober, I turned my will and my life over to God, and God said, not that life, Catherine. I want a completely different one for you. And everything did change. Different house, different job, different city, everything. And it feels like it's, again, I'm like there, and I don't know what God's will is for me today. You know, we got this recession and job situations and husband working in Sweden. And now I just found out 2 weeks ago that the place I'm living, I have to move out of, and, you know. And it's just like, but then I'm speaking at the meeting and remembering the big story. This is just story of what's happening today, you know. But I know not because one of you standing on the podium. That's the only advantage of time. My sobriety is just as stable as anyone else here, right? I'm just an alcoholic. But the advantage of time is I have my own story. I have enough of my own miracles in my own story to know that it's not just a theory that God will be there for me when I need it. It's happened to me. And I'm telling you that it's just like, turn it over, trust God, and then if you can't think of anything else to do, just go help someone. Because helping another alcoholic, if it means secretary at a meeting or just talking to a newcomer, giving that newcomer, I call the newcomer. You know, now I call people because I learn because of my own isolation. But when I'm doing something that makes my life actually, you know, contributing something to another human being, the fact that me in my sobriety, me in my alcoholism, me being the over, like my brothers, they don't, you're so over emotional, Kathy. It's like me being the over emotional, resentful, self-pitying alcoholic that I am, the fact that I walk through it sober and that I can share it with you makes that whole experience worth something. Every single one of our indignities and setbacks that we walk through sober and we learn to be, you know, a little less of a brat and a little more mature, every single one of those things we do sober, instead of it being nothing, all that suffering for nothing, it's like worth something when I can share it with you. And that sense of ease and comfort that I talked about at Morley Field, today I get that in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. When I walk into, you know, when I walk into a meeting and I sit down, it's like, oh, I'm here. You know, I belong. I'm with people who get it. They get that. That being me requires, and sometimes being me requires a lot of effort. But when I sit down in a meeting, then it's all okay. It's okay to be Catherine. It's okay to be an alcoholic. It's okay to have my resentments and fears. I can walk through them. And I remember that there's a God. I somehow forget it sometimes when I'm not in a meeting. But when I'm in a meeting, I remember there's a God. And that everything is, you know, that this too shall pass. And that one day at a time that we can do it together. Thank you for letting me share.